Moncrief on News Talk.
It is time for the Murder Club. Cassie Delaney is here with us once again. And today we're, I suppose, talking about cases that were solved by enthusiastic amateurs, but large groups of them.
That's it. There's gatherings of these people. There really is a you know, a lid for every pot. If you have a hobby, you can find a community you're going to get involved here. These are online sleuths who go at these cases for years, like years and years and years. So we've got a couple of stories where either the victims and the murderers have been identified by people online with access to the same tools as the police, but just probably a little bit more patience to do that. The first one we have is the Grateful Doe. This is a mad story because this goes on for a course of years where it's kind of worrisome. It takes so long to identify this victim because his family weren't even aware that he was missing.
Yeah, that was kind of, I found that a bit sad,
Isn't that aspect of it? Yes, so we're in June in 1995. There is a car left on the road in Virginia and it has crashed. Inside are two young men on their way home from a Grateful Dead concert at the stadium in Washington, D.C. The driver was a 21-year-old man named Michael. He was killed. His family identified him within hours. But the passenger, who was badly injured, had no wallet, no ID, nothing on him that gave investigators a name at all. He had been too damaged in the crash for a sketch or photograph to be used of his face. So he had passed away as well. But what he did have on is a Grateful Dead t-shirt, as many people at the concert would have had, two ticket stubs from that weekend's shows, a star tattoo on one arm that was kind of like a stick and poke tattoo, yeah, kind of homemade, yeah, and a note that read to Jason, apologizing from whoever wrote it that they had to leave without him. But nobody ever traced the note back to the author. Nobody came forward. The dead passenger went into the system as an unidentified deceased and stayed there for 20 years. Became known online as the Grateful Doe. So his mother was a woman named Margaret Evans. She wasn't searching for him because she thought this was just a characteristic thing where he had gone off. Her son Jason had basically said that he was going off to follow the Grateful Dead. He was 19 years of age in 1995 and he was going to go on tour and follow them around like a roadie, following them from city to city.
And people do that for people, the Grateful Dead, Deadheads. Yeah,
yeah, it's mad. Yeah. And in the 90s, different time altogether. People, children could play out in the road. Yeah. It was fine. And then when the calls stopped coming in to check up, she just assumed that he was out there living his life. But for 20 years, no checkups, no cards, no Christmases at home, no contact whatsoever, obviously. She had no idea what state, even when I suppose when she did get word, she had no idea what state to even file a missing persons report in or how to go about this. So this went on for years and years, as I said, until January 2015, when an Australian Reddit user with the name Grey Metal, never met Jason or Margareta in his life, had no personal connection to the case, wasn't even that big a fan of the Grateful Dead. He was really interested in digital reconstruction of images and he did this with incredible skill. And he posted a collection of these photos to a couple of websites. And you know that old site Imgur that had all the memes on it?
Yeah.
He posted a photo album up there. And for whatever reason, this series of photos goes completely viral. It goes, breaks away from these groups entirely and is shared widely on the internet. And then people start trying to get local media organizations to pick it up. And eventually the story gets back to Margareta. So she's a Facebook user. She's not particularly interested in these forums. She's not overly active on the internet. But that's just a testament to how widely received this was. It just, for whatever reasons, kind of caught the imagination of the public. It was shared everywhere across Reddit, Facebook, Twitter. More than 500,000 people see the photograph. And within a few days, two men firstly come forward. One remembered a former roommate from Illinois in 1994, a young man he'd worked alongside in McDonald's who looked like the reconstruction, couldn't recall his last name, but remembered that his first name was Jason, which adds up to the note as well. So after the volunteers are pushing on local media news outlets to report Grey Metal's post, as I said, it gets back to Margareta. And she then sees her son's face rebuilt there and knows immediately that it's him. She posts to the Grateful Doe Facebook group that same day saying, "This is my son, Jason Callahan. I've been looking for him all this time with no luck." And then she files a missing persons report from the following morning, 20 years later. The first official record that Jason Callahan had ever gone missing at all. DNA testing then took 11 months to confirm that it was in fact Jason. And on the 9th of December 2015, the match came back. It was confirmed as Jason Callahan, 19 years old at the time of his death. He'd been hitchhiking, which is why they couldn't figure out a relationship, because they'd obviously gone down Michael, the driver's family, to try and see who this guy was, but they had no idea. So he was hitchhiking. He had been, it was one of his first weekends chasing around the Grateful Dead. So he died very early on in his plans. And Margaretta Evans still posts on Facebook today, still thanking the groups, but goes back to her regular activity, sharing missing dog posts and the likes.
God, that's extraordinary.
Isn't it? It's very sad, really, someone would go missing for that length of time.
And it wouldn't alarm anyone. You wouldn't think after 10 years even. This is a bit of a worry.
Bit sketchy. He's missed a few birthdays here, you know. Yeah, but then I suppose where do you even start to look? I think you'd work backwards from the Grateful Dead concerts. But surely even in that time, they weren't touring right up until 2015, were they?
Oh, I think they were. I mean, they're one of those constantly on the road bands, but it's kind
of a farewell tour that lasted a decade.
Yeah, but they're like, everyone is, they're all about a million years old at this stage. But a lot of the people that follow them probably are as well. Anyway, the next story, this is seriously creepy, this story.
This one's wild because this is solved kind of from two different directions with two hobbyists going at it at the same time. And they find both the victims and the perpetrator. This is quite a well-known story, but some of the stuff that was covered in the media coverage of this has helped solve the case. So in November 1985, there's a hunter walking through the woods in a place called Bear Brook State Park in New Hampshire, and he comes across a metal barrel. People might recognize this story from the podcast Bear Brook, which is brilliant. But inside that barrel are the remains of a woman and a younger girl. Police investigated and found no leads, and the case went cold because there was no DNA in 1985. There was no databases, no search engines. They kind of hit a dead end and they couldn't really go any further with it. Then 15 years later, in 2000, workers are clearing a brush and they find a second barrel only 300 feet from the first.
Yeah, even that you'd think.
Yeah.
You didn't search the area.
Well, see, they did. The kind of thing with this story is that the barrels were potentially stored elsewhere and then over the course of years popped back in places.
Yeah.
So like they would have definitely found a barrel that was 300 feet away in the initial search. So that's the kind of one of the unusual things that was happening at this crime scene. Inside here are two more girls, four victims in total, found 15 years apart, just 30 feet from each other. You would have been able to see the second barrel. And obviously, if you found something dodgy in this one, you're definitely checking the second one. There was other details in these barrels as well, that the decomposition of the bodies was quite slow, considering the age and who they reckon the victims might have been. But nobody had any idea who anybody in the barrels was or who had put them there. So no identity on the victims and no motive, no means. So, you know, they can't really pursue a criminal investigation here with that little detail. But it becomes one of the most notorious unidentified persons cases in all of America. The break comes, I said, from two directions at once, and neither one of them were the police department. The first is a genetic genealogist named Barbara Ray Venter, who spent years using techniques that are widely available to the public to treat crime scene DNA in the same way that you would a hobbyist putting together your family tree. So she's using these little kits that you get sent to your home, they're spat into, and then they're, you know, you're found against this public database. It's a way for the Irish to find their long lost cousins.
Yeah.
The way for the Americans
to find out their auntie was really their mother.
yeah. They're not that popular over here for unknown reasons. It's a way for Americans to trace their history back to Ireland and come over and drink a pint of Guinness. But anyway, these massive databases, whether they're kind of people I think have thoughts and problems with them, but they're these massive databases that people are uploading their DNA to help you connect your family tree. But of course, that technology can be used for crime scene DNA to see if they can find a match anywhere and start narrowing down who this person could be. So Barbara starts building out this reference for the DNA that was found at the crime scene. And it comes down to a single name. She comes to find the man that she believes responsible for these four murders. A man who'd been going by the name Bob Evans, but his real name was Terry Pater Rasmussen. And he was a career criminal who had drifted across America under at least five aliases for years. He had actually been convicted of murdering his later wife and dying in prison in 2010. So as this information is coming out, he's already deceased. He'd never been, you know, held accountable for any of these murders. The second break in this case comes when a woman called Becky Heath, who's a researcher in Connecticut with no police background whatsoever, had just been kind of sticking at the case for years in these forums, taking in as much detail as she possibly could. In 2018, she was listening to a podcast about Bear Brook, and something in that podcast triggered a memory in her that when she was picking at the way at the case, she had come across a name and dismissed it as a coincidental thing. But when she heard the name again, she went deeper and tipped off the police officers. And this helped identify three of the four victims, Marilise Honeychurch and her daughters, Marie and Sarah. So they had been living in California in 1978. And Marilise has brought home a new boyfriend for Thanksgiving dinner that could or potentially, you know, may have been him. Mm. She had never been seen again. But there was one victim still left unnamed, a toddler. And the investigators had spent decades calling the middle child. And that stayed that way until 2024, when the New Hampshire police partnered with the nonprofit called the DNA Doe Project, which essentially is a group of volunteers who'd use these systems to go after the DNA and try and figure this out. So they started working with a little bit of a DNA match they had, and they traced it back to a couple in the 1870s, and then kept tracing, pulling at that thread until they found an obituary for a woman called Pepper Reed, who had vanished in the 1970s. Once they had that name, they found a 1976 birth certificate for her daughter, whose name was Rhea Rasmussen. It was Terry's own child, his own daughter in that barrel.
Gosh.
So that's how they managed to connect that one. And identification was confirmed in September 2025, 40 years after the first barrel was found.
That's extraordinary.
Isn't it? And like pulling in all those threads, finding a match in the database, even if it goes back as far as 1870s, then they go and they go through the kind of census records to see where else they can finding, you know, the death certs of people and then the, you know, the birth certs and different information and piecing it all together that way. Like a really haunted family tree.
Even though they identified who these people were, I suppose they could never find out what the circumstances of their deaths were, what the motive was,
why he killed
his own daughter.
Yeah, and the mother of that child, she wasn't in the barrel. So there was the three, the mother and the two daughters that he potentially dated, mother, they were separate, and then the toddler was in another barrel. So her mother, Pepper, is still her body has never been found. But it's suspected that
the assumption is
that he killed a lot more people and there's a lot more barrels around the place.
My word. Mm. Right. This one isn't funny because it deals with somebody's death, but the discovery of part of the corpse is really weird. So anyway, Gregory May,
this does answer the question of like, if you come across a piece of a body and you don't know who it is, and there's no open investigation, I mean, what do you do with that evidence?
Mm.
In this case, it sits on top of a filing cabinet for a really long time. We're in 2001. There's an antiques dealer named Gregory May, and he is described as the kind of person that if he went missing for a while, what I've gathered from this story is that nobody would necessarily report him missing until it became absolutely certain that he was missing, because he seems like he might have been a little bit annoying.
Okay.
That's the sense that I got. We all know this kind of guy. He's a Civil War memorabilia collector, and he goes around the country often collecting, you know, new bits and trading things. So if he went missing for a couple of days on end, it wasn't considered that unusual. He had been living with a friend named Douglas De Bruyn and De Bruyn's girlfriend, Julie, for a few months. When he's not heard from for a couple of weeks, his family assumed he's out chasing an antique or that he had made plans to go to Florida and move there. Again, there's not a lot of communication going on between these families, but it took weeks and weeks before anybody issued a report on this. By the time anybody did, the roommate Douglas and the girlfriend had gone on the road and they were selling off May's Civil War collection.
Okay.
So,
yeah,
you know, that's triggering something alarming. They're selling off his possessions and no one has really been aware that he's missing or potentially murdered. They're arrested in April 2001 in Arizona trying to unload his antiques. And so the investigators are trying to piece together things that they do suspect that maybe he has been murdered, but they have no body, they have no crime scene, so they do not really know where to go with this. Then 7 months after he vanished in August 2001, a trucker stops at a stop in Missouri, notice a bucket full of concrete, decides that he wants the bucket, like again, a very unfortunate series of coincidences here, decides he wants the bucket, kicks it, turns it upside down and tries to get the concrete that's set in the middle out of the bucket to keep the book. It must have been a really nice bucket.
It must have been, yeah.
And when he did that, the concrete chipped away and what is found is a skull, some hair and apparently skin, which smelt, according to reports, horrendous. So he calls the police. Nobody comes to the bucket. He comes back a month later to see if maybe his bucket's back there and it's still sitting there.
That's bizarre.
Isn't it? Bizarre. Just so strange. But like, there's no reports of a missing person who fits this potential evidence. So they just leave it sitting in a petrol station.
Even if they don't know whose head it is, you'd imagine they'd be alarmed.
Unless they realised that it was Gregory's and they weren't that interested.
I don't know.
But eventually, the skull is pulled outside and extracted. Nothing again to connect it to Gregory or, you know, any open cases. It's simply a skull, unidentified. And it sits in police property for years. Eventually, a man called Lieutenant O'Leary sent it to another Philadelphia forensic sculptor called Frank Bender. And he, again, is really good at reconstructing faces out of clay. He does this with the skull and the bust is then sent back to O'Leary in September 2002, where it sits on his filing cabinet, watching him every morning, every night, for years and years and years. Now, sporadically, O'Leary is going to these forums to try and find if it matches any missing person case and trying to put the information out there. And eventually he posts a photograph of the bust onto a DOE network and it's a volunteer run database for unidentified remains. There's a woman, Ellen Leach, who works from her home. She is a Home Depot employee. Do you know, just again, picks this up as a hobby. And what she has is almost a photographic memory for faces. So she spends her day scanning through missing persons lists and memorizing their faces. And when she sees the bust, she manages to connect it to a photograph she saw of Gregory May, who'd been missing since 2001. I think the disparity here and the issue here is that Gregory May is described as having long, shaggy hair, a mustache, and like kind of the features that might cover up his natural face. Mm. So people would be seeing a bust without all that detail. But Ellen Leach managed to kind of just noticed a little few things about the eyebrows and the hairline and the nose that matched the picture. So she submitted the tip in. The tip even sat there for 4 months before O'Leary came across it.
And to be really annoying,
just,
this guy.
Yeah, it's like a little side crochet project that you're tipping away at in the winter time, but then something else important comes back. But the exciting thing about this is they get a match with dental records 2 days before De Bruyn's trial was supposed to go ahead. So that trial would have been one of the first murder cases to ever go ahead without finding a body. Mm. But 2 days, just in the nick of time, they get a confirmed match and the evidence they need to put De Bruyn away. It turns out that De Bruyn had strangled May with a nylon cord and the girlfriend, Julie Miller, had testified that she helped dismember him afterwards. She served 3 years for transporting stolen property, but De Bruyn got life without the possibility of parole. Ellen Leach, that woman, has gone on to identify 7 more missing people, probably for your man O'Leary.
Yeah, but the girlfriend only got 3 years.
Yeah.
Even though she helped chop his head off and stick it in a bucket.
I mean, she was probably put up to it, maybe scared for her own life.
Maybe.
Who knows?
Yeah.
Maybe she didn't profit off the memorabilia either.
Yeah.
Doesn't sound like a good time for anyone, to be fair.
Doesn't really, but what an odd way to dispose of a body. Anyway, Cassie, thanks a million as ever. That was Cassie Delaney there.
Moncrief, weekdays at 2 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.